Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How can church leaders shift and adapt to the rapid cultural changes experienced by younger adults? Listen as Lewis Center Associate Director Ann Michael speaks with Reverend Scott Krosnick about his book, The Kaleidoscope Effect, What Emerging Generations Seek in New Leaders.
I'm Ann Michael, Associate Director of the Lewis Center and editor of Leading Ideas newsletter, and I'm here today for a Leading Ideas Talks podcast and interviewing Reverend Scott Krosnick, who's lead pastor of Resurrection Downtown. We're going to be talking about his most recent book, which is The Kaleidoscope Effect, What Emerging Generations Seek in Leaders. So, Scott, welcome. It's good to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me with you.
Yeah, so as we're getting started, for people who aren't familiar with Resurrection Downtown or your particular ministry setting, could you take just a minute or two to describe what you've been up to in downtown Kansas City?
Absolutely, yeah. In Resurrection Downtown, we are a campus of the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection. We are the downtown campus. We're about 25 miles from our Leawood setting, which is in Leawood, Kansas. We're in Kansas City, Missouri. We launched back in 2009. You know, my wife and I had moved here from Detroit to get things up off the ground and running. And since then, it's been really taking off. In the last 8 years, it'll be 8 years at Christmas time. In the last 8 years, we've been growing. We've expanded to two buildings. We just purchased and are building our third building. We have just about 1,000 people a weekend in worship, adults, and then most of those people, at least half anyway, are under the age of 35 or so. And the other balance is above the age of 45, so about 50% above 45, about 50% below 35. And it's been this crazy adventure, you know, really of ministry in the heart of the city. And one of the great badges I get to wear now is being able to lead a congregation that's building the first church in downtown Kansas City in over 80 years. And so we are just having so much fun at life at Resurrection Downtown. Over the last several years. I just can't wait to share about it. I love talking about it.
Yeah. Wow. It's such an amazing, amazing success story to be doing what you're doing in the particular context. Maybe you could just name what you think some of the challenges and opportunities have been within the particular urban context that you're serving.
Well, it's really, really, I'm glad that you said that, like challenges and opportunities, because most challenges have become great opportunities. But one of the things that we talk about, at least locally, is that we are a very eclectic congregation. So when you're doing ministry in the middle of a city, you're literally with everybody. Everybody is present and everybody is visible. And so we have a really diverse context. You know, we're about 35% or maybe a little less working poor or homeless. We're very diverse when it comes to socioeconomic status. We're really diverse, of course, with age, but as well, like every facet of diversity, we seem to be like right in the middle of it, and so that's become a challenge. Like, how do you communicate effectively to a very eclectic congregation? That's one thing. One of the things, though, that has become beautiful is we realize that everybody, regardless of how different you may feel or your worldview may seem, everybody is really cleaving for the same thing, and so what we talk about at Resurrection Downtown is that you can come to worship with us at any one of our services, and we have 10 seats per row, and in any of those 10 seats, you're going to see a very different mix. You'll have a CEO who's sitting next to a service industry employee, next to somebody who's fresh off the street, next to an attorney, next to somebody who's in med school, next to like a rising professional in their early 20s, and it's like everybody's sitting next to one another. And you never know who's who.
Yeah, that really is one of the joys of urban America. I live in downtown D.C. and I have to say, I mean, I think that's the great gift, is the fact that your neighbor, you live among such a diverse range of neighbors that you can't close your eyes to any particular kinds of people or any kind of particular circumstances. So, but it's wonderful to see a church being born in the midst of that.
Well, when we first started, we said you're living on top of each other, right? So we're stacked up in these apartment buildings or loft buildings or condo buildings. And even though you're living like in the same building as maybe like 250 other people or households, there's also a profound sense of loneliness, because once you go through your door, there's not that sense of, even though you're with all these people, you're also sometimes feeling like you're empty or alone. And so what we found is that that diversity that's so present, it's all cleaving for that same kind of community, that same kind of communion, or that same kind of what I would call unconditional love that really binds our church together. And you can find it in a very unique way in a downtown setting, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think there is an irony that the closer you live to people, sometimes the more boundaries you put up to preserve your own privacy. I know I was struck when I moved from an apartment for the first time into a home that I actually knew my neighbors better than I did to the people who were living just literally across the hall from me, because I saw them more regularly coming and going from their home, and I think I didn't feel the need to sort of be quite as private. Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I read your book, I'm very struck that we live in an era when the success rate for new church plants and for the formation of new worship services is really often pretty dismal, and yet you've managed to succeed. And I think what strikes me particularly about that is that you've succeeded with what at least appears to be a fairly traditional model of, you know, sending people into a targeted geographic area and getting people on the ground and forming a leadership team and then, you know, launching worship in borrowed or rented space, and now moving on to building your own building. It looks to me anyways like a pretty classic parachute drop. And so I wanted to ask you about that, if that's how you see it, and if so, maybe why it succeeded for you when it doesn't seem to be as successful in other settings these days.
Well, one of the best parts about like Resurrection Downtown, I mean, yeah, I think on one hand, you know, it felt like a parachute drop just because I moved here, and when I say here, to Kansas City, sight unseen from Detroit. So I was kind of flying in by myself, as though I was parachuting into the center of the city. But on the other hand, we're a campus of Church of the Resurrection, and we have a great leadership team, you know, in our Leawood campus. And really, what they offered was great clarity of vision and purpose, prayer. And one of the things that we've been unmistakably clear of from the moment I started was our purpose. And that's to build, you know, Christian community where non-religious and nominally religious people are becoming deeply committed. And so for us, like, we never had to worry about our vision or our mission or our purpose. And so even though I might have dropped in, you know, we didn't have a whole bunch of people to start with, we had like a clarity of our vision and purpose. And that drove me. That drove everything I did. You know, and Pastor Adam really, you know, pushes us to let that purpose drive everything we do. It should be the bellwether upon which we decide to do or not do anything, you know, in our daily activity. And so for me, that was the number one gift that I had been given, was a really clear purpose. And the beautiful thing, the challenge was, we didn't have any space. I didn't have a leadership team. You know, I call it my band of misfits. We had a band of misfits, nine misfit individuals. And I would say they were loosely committed. And so what instead we had was just this dire, urgent need to go out into the community to meet people where they were. And that's kind of what propelled us, was we had no space. We didn't have a leadership team. We had a really compressed timeline, and we had a clear and unwavering purpose. And so that filtered through every conversation I had, like every cup of coffee, every place I ventured to. And then my misfit, you know, group of missionaries, like, they with me, it funneled all of our activity. And so we tried in our daily lives to be wherever people were, so that we could invite them to join us on this journey of building Christian community. And because we didn't have a critical mass, or because we didn't have a leadership base to begin with, what that meant was, like, everybody we were meeting were fulfilling our purpose. So I think a lot of that kind of came together to really give us this outward focused, invitational, really mission-minded, you know, relational ministry that invited people as we met them where they were to join us on this journey. And my favorite place were coffee shops, to meet people in coffee shops. And so when I'm writing the Kaleidoscope Effect, or when I'm thinking about how it is that we've managed to meet all these people under the age of 35, it's largely because we went to where they were and invited them to join us in building community, instead of inviting them to join us at a worship service or at an established setting or at a meeting that already had a critical mass of people. And so really everything we were was outwardly focused, just by nature of our big beginning. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah, I know. That's actually really helpful, because what I was going to ask you next is, you know, where some of the newer approaches to forming new faith communities, I was thinking particularly of like Fresh Expressions, where, you know, they're taking the church's presence out into community groups or whatever. And it sounds like you were really using some of that same outward focus, taking church to the community. I mean, you really were using a missional as opposed to an attractional model, even though in the end, you know, you were still building a pretty traditional looking church.
Yeah. So now, I mean, just by nature of where we are, it feels traditional. You know, our services are very traditional in terms of like its order and structure. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our models are traditional. Like, I mean, we have you know, small groups that happen. We have community gatherings that bring people together that eventually foster connections to go to small groups. We have children's ministries, and we have really structured kind of traditional structure when it comes to our mission and our ministry. But what's really been fascinating is like our tension that we feel now is, how do we continue that missional DNA that formed us from our very beginning, while realizing, because of our size and our scope, we have to also have some structure that's traditional, or feels traditional anyway. And that's where the kaleidoscope metaphor comes in beautifully, because what I find with the people under the age of 35 is that they are so quick to move, and trends change, and shifting cultures happen so rapidly that what we realize is that we need to continue to shift and adapt the same way. So kaleidoscopes are beautiful. They're timeless toys that are intended to adapt so that you can always see something new, something beautiful. They help us to see beautiful images, beautiful things. And that's kind of the way the church has to be.
Right.
And so we've had all sorts of strategies to connect with our younger demographics within the congregation. And what we realize is that whatever we do, it works for a while until it doesn't. And then what we have to be willing to do is to try again, or to rotate our strategy, or to adapt what we were doing in a way that now meets people with great, nimble, strategic flexibility where they are. And so there's a chapter where I talk about all of the different ways that we tried to reach out to this under 35 groups with different titles, with different activities, with different backgrounds, and all of them worked for a while. Mm-hmm. Until they didn't, and then we had to start all over again.
Yep. You know, I was going to ask you about that exact part of the book, in fact, because that was certainly the biggest takeaway for me, was this idea that leadership needs to be adaptive and innovative and constantly improvising. And that example you mentioned of the groups reaching out to young people really stayed with me. And I think, you know, that rings true, I think, to anybody who's in ministry today. But here's the question. Can we reasonably ever expect to get it right? Do you hope that you're going to sometime land in some sweet spot where continued efforts are going to actually bear fruit? Or do you think that what it means to be in ministry today is just to be on a constant, I don't want to use a negative metaphor, but hamster wheel comes to mind, where I think that's the way it feels to a lot of people, that it's just this constant need to do the next best thing, because so many things aren't working.
Yeah, that's a great question. Hamster wheel is a good good image. I got to tell you, like, I don't think, and I haven't been in ministry as long as like a lot of my colleagues have been, and I didn't grow up in the church either. But I'll tell you, like, my experience of ministry has never been one where you figure out a recipe and then you just coast. When I read like scripture, I look at Jesus's model of ministry. I don't ever see that that he gets to a point in his ministry where he feels like he's hit it out of the ballpark, and so now he's going to coast. I think our news cycles, I think trends, I think what's popular, it always needs to be forward focused and ever changing, so that you stay relevant and stay in the mission field, meaning where people are, and you're engaging people in ways that they can understand or ways that. And so I think you're always adapting and you're always trying something new. And the fruit isn't necessarily measured in one-time success. The fruit is measured in the cumulative impact of a passion that seeks to meet people so that we can continue to build Christian community. I think the second we build a program that bears fruit and then just hit like rinse and repeat, over and over again, that's when we lose, I think, perhaps one of the best gifts that we have, which is to be like creative in ministry, bold in ministry, innovative, like forward moving. And so I think I've never experienced a restful moment in ministry, if that makes sense. And
right.
And so I would say failing forward is like that was somebody that I think, I can't remember who wrote that expression, but that idea of being comfortable failing. Realizing that everything will come to an end, that doesn't mean you're a failure. That mm-hmm. means you have a chance to start something new. And I think that's been really indicative of who we are. Like, we make mistakes or we get it wrong. Only that wrong attempt makes it possible for us to get it right the next time.
Yeah. And I think one of the lovely things your book does is puts a positive metaphor around that and puts it out in terms of the exciting challenge as opposed to the seeing it as failure, because I think often that's how it feels.
It feels like that.
Mm-hmm. Tom Berlin, in one of his books, has a beautiful metaphor. He says we're working in sand. And we have to remember that you build a sandcastle and it's going to get washed away with the next wave. And that's just the nature of ministry. And, if we think otherwise, we're fooling ourselves. But that's also a blessing in a way. It's new every day. And that's the challenge that God puts before us.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought up the misfit mission, because I was going to pull a question from that as well. And you mentioned all the coffee houses. I think the thing that stayed with me so profoundly from that book was how you described that first month on the ground in Kansas City, where you were in 33 different coffee houses and set a goal of talking to 35 different people every day. For the benefit of our listeners, describe what that kind of deliberate outreach was like for you.
To be honest, that outreach, deliberate outreach that you say, it was kind of a default mode. So when we hit the ground in Kansas City and realized that we had to really generate, critical mass fairly quickly, I kind of hit that low point, in my own personal. So on first blush, like, I think that was fairly exhausting. And my background's in finance and investments, and one of the ways I broke into the business was making cold calls, 300 calls a day. And so I was fairly good. One of my spiritual gifts is to be able to handle rejection fairly well, and determined. And I know that if I just keep pressing on, I'll get to where I need to be, because activity creates results. And if we're willing to do the things that God does, then we're going to bear fruit that will last. And so like, I'm pretty determined in that way. And so when I realized we needed to move, I realized I needed to kind of go back into that cold call mode, or that activity generating, results kind of mode. And so that's what prompted really a discipline to try to meet people where they were and measure my activity. And so I didn't want to make 300 phone calls a day. I wanted to get to know this new city that I'd moved to and get to know the people there and start to fulfill a mission. And so that's what really, there was nothing scientific about it. I kind of set a contact ratio of, if I made 35 contacts a day, if I talked to 35 different people a day, and if I measured that activity and I made that my primary job, then I know that if I was faithful to that work, then I would experience, results. I'd experience fruit. I'd build relationships and cultivate friendships and start to form community. And I tell people when I speak in places, the only reason I went to coffee shops is because Kansas City is a coffee shop culture. And at the age of 9, my grandmother gave me my first cup of coffee. And I am just comfortable in coffee shops. I'm comfortable with a cup of coffee in my hand, and I am my best version of the person God created me to be when I'm sitting in a coffee shop. And so I can become extroverted. I can become other focused. I can become really at ease and engage people there. And so that just happened to be my venue. And I'm also really great at small talk and engaging people in conversation. And so that was just kind of what I felt like I needed to use in order to become the person that God needed me to be in Kansas City. And so those are the gifts I've been given. And not everybody has those gifts, but what I found is that everybody can measure activity meeting people where they are. And if it's not coffee and small talk conversation in coffee shops, then it's something else. And I always challenge people to find that arena or that portion of their life where they can become an ambassador for God's grace or for a Christian community, and begin building it there, because I think that's what it looks like to go and make disciples of all nations by being comfortable where you are and ministering to the people around you in those contexts. And for me, it was coffee shops. 33 and 31 days, there's nothing magical about that other than I needed to fulfill 35 contacts a day, and I was getting bored at the same places. So.
well, thank you for your clarity on that, because I think, you know, so many people have the ideal in their head of wanting to get out and connect with their community, but don't really have a tangible, measurable strategy for what that looks like in their context or given their own gifts. And I think the way you've just expressed that makes it so real. And I really appreciated that part of your book for that reason.
Yeah.
Let me ask another question. The subtitle of Kaleidoscope Effect is What Emerging Generations Seek in Leaders. Can you speak to that briefly?
Yeah, well, and I've been working with a place called Burlap. And Burlap works with a lot of, Generation Y, Generation Z. They do a lot of research. And one of the things I did was I really pulled from their research and then compared that with my experience of ministry over the last 8 years in Kansas City. And one of the things I realized is that there's some really resonating things or there are some characteristical traits that resonate with the emerging generations in terms of what they look for in a leader. And so, I listed in the book 15, key traits, but I tried to kind of pare them down and really almost boil them down into some of the most important. And whether those are authenticity and humility or vulnerability, all three of those kind of seem to move together. But then empathetic and relatable and passionate, but also visionary, communicative, so I put together like a whole bunch of traits I think people are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this book, I was inviting, people to realize that these are all things that actually most of us embody. And they sometimes fly in the face of how the church kind of sometimes positions leadership or models leadership. Now, what I found just at Resurrection Downtown is that a lot of people that come to our church that are maybe visiting for the first time or that I've met out in the community, they are looking for people that are willing to be relatable, to be open, vulnerable, humble, authentic. And what that really means for me is they need to see somebody who's comfortable in their own skin. And they need to see somebody who's able to make mistakes, in public and not pretend that they're perfect. Or they need to see people that struggle and that wrestle with things that don't necessarily all have all of the answers. And so a lot of these leadership traits are things that we all embody. And in fact, some of those things that we are afraid to kind of share, our unwillingness to share them become stumbling blocks to ministry with millennials. And so I talk with a lot of pastors that try to get all of their ducks in a row before they start reaching out to the emerging generations in ministry. And what I think a lot of people realize and what they want is that they want something that isn't perfect, doesn't have all their ducks in a row, that are a work in progress. And I think the church is at its best when it's willing to say we're a work in progress. So authenticity, humility, vulnerability, those were some of the leading traits that I lift out as being some of the most important, optimistic and visionary. Those are some of the other passionate. Those are some of the others that come to fore as well. But
And I think what I appreciate about what's in your book with regard to those things, and also just as you've expressed it just now, is, I mean, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard authentic as a buzzword when people talk about engaging millennials, and it's a buzzword. And I think what's wonderful about what you've just said and about what you share in your book is you unpack that. I mean, you really describe what it means to be authentic and humble and vulnerable in terms of building a ministry and outreach. It becomes, again, a more tangible construct, not just an ideal.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we're asking, or a couple things that we're asking all the people that we're interviewing for Leading Ideas talks, one is, what leader has inspired you most?
Oh, that's a great question. I have a kind of a different, I consider like a personal advisory board. But if you were to ask me, like, initially here, you know, since I've been in Kansas City, I got to tell you, our senior pastor, Adam Hamilton, has been very influential and really inspiring for me. Sometimes when you get close to people who have big reputations, you don't like what you see once you get close to them. And as I've gotten to know our senior pastor more, I've grown in respect because of his humility, because of his desire to meet people who don't yet know who God is, and to lead congregations in the same way. He's been a really strong influence in my life in terms of being mission-minded and purpose-focused. And so he comes to mind just first and foremost. But I've had several leaders. Maybe one of the best in my life has been my grandmother, and my grandmother is somebody that I wish was still here. But she led with a quiet sort of strength that has really emboldened me. What I didn't tell you about when she gave me my first cup of coffee when I was 9 is that I was dying to be at the adult table at Thanksgiving, and she told me I had to drink what the adults drink, and that meant coffee black. But she was always willing to respect me and to listen to me, and to, even though I was small and young and insignificant, she was always making me feel to be big. And I really try to embody that as I seek to live in ministry. I pay attention to people who maybe are ignored, who maybe are small and insignificant based on the world's view, and invite them by the grace of God to experience something big. And so she's somebody that I carry with me every day. And that's part of the reason why I drink so much coffee still. And so when I went to coffee shops, I would think about who's in this room, who's in this cafe that needs to experience something big today. And I'd go and kind of channel my inner grandma and lead that way. There's so many other voices too, like Bill Ritter, who's was a leader in the Detroit Annual Conference. He is somebody that continues to speak to me, and he's just released a whole catalog of all of his archived sermons. And so I've been rereading his sermons lately. And these were some of the sermons that spoke to me when I was discerning a call into the ministry. And so there's a whole really group of people that I pay attention to. I listen to Andy Stanley's podcast with great regularity, though. I really enjoy his leadership podcast as well. And so that's more of a modern day, everyday kind of leader that I've been listening to lately.
Yeah. Well, thank you for mentioning all of those people. I think I'm struck that there is a great cloud of witnesses that you are surrounded by, and that you're inspired by, and that's a good word. And my goodness, I mean, we have all been blessed so greatly by Adam Hamilton's leadership, and what a great blessing it must be to you to be working with him so closely. Let me ask another question that we ask of all of our interviewees, and that's, what are you reading right now?
Oh, that's another great question. What am I reading right now? I'm like knee deep in Advent stuff, and so I'm reading a whole bunch of glamour, lack of glamour. There's no glamour. I'm reading a bunch of commentaries on the Gospel of Luke, so that's what I'm reading currently, like right as we speak. But I'm reading a whole bunch of other books as well. I just read Fail by Matt Miosky, which is good. Jacob Armstrong, I just read his book, and those are two more recent books that I've read. I reread Good to Great just because it's an oldie but a goodie, and I want to to rethink staff structure and team. And Deep and Wide by Andy Stanley, I just had our staff team reread that. And I reread it. They read it for the very first time as a way of reengaging us from a mission mindset. So those are some of the books that are fresh off the shelf. But I really liked Matt's book, Fail, and Jacob's Renovate. Those were two great books that I just enjoyed personally.
Yeah, I like them as well. So let me finish this up by asking you, if there's one word of advice that you would give to young people who are entering ministry today. I have the privilege of working with a lot of younger clergy and a lot of students who are at the front end of their career in ministry. They're coming into ministry in a time of so much change and so much challenge, and yet, you know, so many interesting opportunities. Is there a single word of advice that you would want to share with them?
Yes, I would say don't settle. And when I say don't settle, one of the things that drives me is that Jesus longs for us to believe that we have the capacity to do the things that he does, maybe even greater things. And I would also say that the Apostle Paul pushes us to remember that by the grace of Jesus Christ, we're able to accomplish more than we can think to ask for or imagine. And so when I say don't settle, I would say don't settle for predictable pathways in ministry. Push. And one of the things I know that I long for within our church is to build and to start new congregations and to plant new communities of faith in hearts of cities or in contexts wherever it is that they are, rural or suburban, because what we need is new life emerging. And that happens beautifully when we can plant and when we can start new. And so I'd really encourage, I did not, when I was going through seminary and when I was entertaining my first appointments, in ministry, I really didn't have much more imagination than to think beyond like an associate pastor role or a pastor of a 3-point charge. And one of the things I realized is that you have energy when you're in the beginning portion of your ministry. You can run fast and you can run hard. And what a great opportunity would it be to get more people involved in planting new congregations and starting new communities of faith. And so I'd urge anybody not to settle for predictable pathways, but to seek out new ones. And to consider whether or not God is calling you as a part of your ministry to start new communities of faith and to be emboldened in that way. One of the things I thank God for every day is the opportunity to launch a new community in downtown Kansas City. And I'm grateful for this privilege and for this invitation. And I want to encourage as many people possible. Right now I'm coaching about 8 church planters. Over the last 4 years, I've coached, I think, north of 16 or 17. And I love and have a passion for that. And I don't encourage anybody who's early on in their ministry to consider that.
Well, I want to thank you for the power of that word, because it is really, you're speaking great truth, and it's very inspiring to hear you say it the way that you're saying it. And I want to thank you for the witness of your work in Kansas City and in through your books. We are really grateful for what you've been able to share with the broader church world, and we're grateful that you've taken the time to talk with us today. So thank you, Scott, for this conversation and for the great work that you're doing there, and I pray that God continues to bless your work.
Hey, thank you so much, Anne. I really appreciate this opportunity, and thanks for enduring my book, and thank you for enduring this conversation.
Oh my goodness, no. Thank you so much, Scott.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by the new Welcome Video Toolkit. Learn concepts and strategies to welcome and respond to your first time and repeat visitors, reach younger generations, expand your church's entry point, and get new people involved. The new Welcome is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/newwelcome. In the next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Director F. Douglas Poe speaks with thought leader Reverend Junius Dotson about moving from being inward-focused to outward-focused.
I got to tell you, I was with some of my team, and when he gave the first key, we all looked at each other, and that was a big, okay. His first key was see people. In other words, that we have to see people as persons who have goals and aspirations and people who have a story. And so when you begin to see people, and it obviously dovetailed into our see all the people thing that we're doing, it's really, you know, once you begin to do that, you begin to relate to people differently, which the second key was adjust efforts. And so his argument was that if we begin to see people and as people, not as pawns in some, you know, to help us achieve our goals or our objectives, but if we actually see people and really have a real desire to see change and impact in their lives, then the natural result of that is that we will adjust our efforts.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.